The titles of your two collections of lyrics come from your song Finishing the Hat and Sunday in the Park with George. It's a song about the artist's total absorption in your work. And is that what you wanted to do with these books, to take us inside the creative process?
No, I just needed a title. But I did want to take everybody. I did want to. Sure, sure. It is about, exactly. I wanted to just tell people about one particular kind of craft, which I've been practicing for a very long time. And, I think it's fun. I think it's fun to read about anybody who has devoted a large portion of his or her life to a particular kind of craft. You know, I'm not a cook, but I love reading the detailed aspects about cooking that I occasionally read in cooking columns or in the Wednesday section of the New York Times. And it fascinates me because it's about a particular set of skills applied to a particular product, so to speak. And and the same thing is true if I read something about, you know, the raising of cattle. If somebody is telling me technically about the specifics of raising cattle, it's fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. And I think learning about a set of skills and a craft is something that interests a lot of people.
So
and,
is this more craft than art, or is that a meaningless distinction?
It's not a meaningless distinction, but it's about both. But in the first book particularly, I wanted to go into the craft of lyric writing, which is, you know, very, very, very a narrow kind of endeavor. You know, it's a corner of a cottage industry. And because I'm talking only about writing lyrics and songs for the theater, as opposed to the vast number of songs that are written outside of the theater. This is about a very specific kind of writing. And but there are a lot of people who like musicals and songs from musicals enough so that they'd be interested, I thought, in hearing one craftsman talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you started out as a lyricist, writing songs for West Side Story and Gypsy, but for decades you've been both composer and lyricist, which is somewhat unusual when you look back at the great
musicals.
Well,
not really, because I did start out as a composer and lyricist. It's just my first job was just writing lyrics, and that was because I needed a job. And when I was lucky enough to be offered West Side Story, I didn't leap at it, as I wrote in the first book. I didn't want to do it, but it was Oscar Hammerstein, who was my mentor, who said, no, you should do this. I know you want to write music, but you should do this because you'll be working with first-rate artists like Leonard Bernstein and Arthur Lawrence and Jerome Robbins, and you'll learn a great deal by doing. You know, he said, you know, you've learned from me by teaching, but now you'll learn by doing.
Hmm. Why didn't you want to do that at first?
Oh, because lyric writing is not anywhere near as much fun or even as satisfying as writing music. I find it very difficult to write lyrics, and I do a great deal of sweating, and they don't often come out as well as I would like them to. And I think that may be the experience of many lyricists. There's so many restrictions, both in terms of language and the way words fit with music, that the chances of writing a really good lyric are, I won't say slim, but they're not great. You really have to keep at it. It's an awful lot of sweat work. And I'm sure that a novelist would say the same thing is true of writing a novel or a painter of painting a painting, but I can only speak for myself. And since I have two choices, I would much rather, it's much more fun to write music.
Hmm. So when you're working on a new piece of work, do you start with the words and then layer the music on top, or do they come kind of simultaneously?
That's simultaneously. Usually having discussed for weeks with the librettist what's going to happen and how songs will function in a show, and then the librettist starts to write the libretto so I can have a style to follow and to imitate. And then I usually start at the beginning, and since you spot where you want the songs to go, at least to begin with, the first few songs, it's useful to come up with a refrain line or a line that sums up what any given song is about. And if you can think of that idea, sometimes that will suggest a tune, because I believe in tunes coming out of the inflection of language. I write conversational lyrics, so if I write a lyric that expresses finishing the hat, then da-da-da-da-dum, right away there's a rhythm there, finishing the hat. And maybe if I said it that way, the melody would go up, but finishing the hat is the way I would say it, so the melody goes up and then drops a little bit. So often a lyric idea will suggest a tune. On the other hand, I also like to fiddle with harmonic language for the show itself and melodic ideas for the show itself that have nothing to do with lyrics until I set them. And then I sometimes set the music. But essentially, they go in together in pairs, the lyrics and the music. Hmm. You develop one because you run the risk otherwise of writing a lyric and then finishing it and then not finding music that really fits it the way you want it to and that you like. So you have to sort of mold the two kinds of clay together at the same time.
Now, you dispense various pieces of wisdom about how to write lyrics. One is less is more. And I'm wondering if you've always known that or was that something you had to learn over time?
Oh, no, that's something I learned over time. You know, all beginning writers, I would say, are verbose when they start. They have too many words and too many notes. And I remember Oscar once said, he was talking about his collaboration with Jerome Kern, and I can't remember exactly how he put it in my head, but what it amounted to was, why don't you kind of see if you can write a melody composed of whole notes? He didn't actually say that, but meaning very few notes in the melody instead of bada 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 bada, which is what most young writers do because it's very hard to observe less is more. But generally, less is more, and particularly in songwriting, I think, and stage songwriting. But, you know, you listen to a lot of stage songs today, and there are so many words and so many notes. And to my ear, they get tiring and tedious quite often. And
I would think the temptation would be to get carried away by the cleverness of the language. You know, maybe rhymes within rhymes, that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, but also, we all over-talk when we're making points, when we're in conversation. We're all saying more than is necessary to say, but that's conversation. But when you're going to then formalize the conversation into an art form, then I think you have to pack it in such a way that it has the most effect on the listener. And generally, that comes about from paring things down, not from expanding them. It is very easy to tire the ear, and particularly if not only are you being sung at, but there's stuff going on the stage. There are many things to concentrate on, everything from the lighting to the scene, and I think you have to give a lyric air, and you have to make your points as concisely and swiftly as possible. Unless, of course, if you're writing for a garrulous character, like I pointed this out, you know, in the chapter on Sweeney Todd and Finishing the Hat, that, you know, Mrs. Lovett is a garrulous woman. So her first song is, you know, very verbose, but that's because of who she is. That's not the songwriter being verbose. That's the character being verbose.
Mm-hmm. So generally, so when you look back on some of your early lyrics, do you think you overdid it at times?
Oh, well, yeah. Well, I didn't overdo it in West Side Story because those are not verbose characters, but it's very heavily overly poetic with a capital P. Because that's what Leonard Bernstein wanted me to do, and I was 25 years old, and I did what I was told. to a certain, and by the time we got through writing it, when I was 27, I was a little more my own master, and so the last few songs I wrote, I think are much better, the last few lyrics. But after that, I learned that I could I didn't have to I didn't have to do what I was told anymore.
So as a lyricist, are you basically writing poetry?
No, poetry. I think of it as light verse if it has to be labeled. The whole idea of poetry is the compactness and the suggested resonance of ideas and images and that sort of thing. For a poem to be rich, it's got to be much richer than, and if you put music to it, it's just as I said before, it, and as they say in England, over eggs the pudding. It's all too rich. Music is so rich in and of itself, you have to underwrite lyrics, I think. which is why most lyrics do not read particularly well on the page. My favorite example being the one I opened the first book with, which is "Oh, what a beautiful morning, oh, what a beautiful day." When you look at the lyric of "Oh, what a beautiful morning," it's really not very interesting, and it's rather flat, and it has very little resonance to it. But when you hear it with the music that it was meant to accompany, because lyrics accompany music just the way music accompanies lyrics, it soars, and it's very rich and full of feeling and atmosphere and exactly what it should. But poems are by nature, I think, suggestive, and I think you can't do that in a theater because the audience doesn't have a chance to slow down and read it at their own pace. Lyrics exist in time, and the time is dictated by the music, and you don't get a chance to hear a line a second time unless it's a refrain line, and you certainly don't get a chance to stop and go back to the beginning of the line. When you read poetry, everybody reads at a different pace. You would read a poem maybe at a faster pace than I if you were getting it and I wasn't getting it. So you have to take your time reading poetry, I think, and you can't do that in the theater. So that's the fundamental difference between lyrics and poetry, and I think lyrics have to be underwritten.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to sort of go into one of your shows in particular, sort of as a kind of case study, and sort of talk about how you put together this kind of thing. And I was thinking of your 1987 show, Into the Woods. Why did you want to mix together all these classic fairy tales, you know, Little Red Riding Hood, Cinderella, Jack and the Beanstalk, into one story?
Well, it started out because James Lapine, who wrote the book, and I, we were looking to make a book, and we came up with an idea of a TV special in which all the characters in those days would meet. That is, say, Lucy and Ricky would meet Ralph Cramden and his wife, and all these characters from all the situation comedies would be in some kind of gigantic accident, all be taken to a hospital where there would be Dr. Kildare and Dr. and all the characters, all the medical characters from TV. So it would be an all-star special with everybody playing the characters that they played on their various different network situation comedies. And so we thought we could sell that idea, because it seemed like a good idea, to Norman Lear, who was the producer of All in the Family and probably the most far-seeing situation comedy producer at the time. And he liked the idea fine and said, sure, go ahead and write it. Sounds great. And we said, no, we don't want to write it. We just want to sell you the idea and then you get your writers. And he said, no, I'll tell you what. You write it and then we'll talk about it. So we got nowhere with it. But then when I said to Lapine after we'd written Sunny in the Park with George, I said, let's do another one. He said, what kind of show would you like to do? I said, I'd like to write a quest musical, something along the lines of The Wizard of Oz, but some kind of quest with a kind of a fantasy feeling, a fantasy quest. And so James started to try to do that and then said, you know, the trouble is there are no parameters. You can just make up anything when you're telling this kind of story. He said, how about if, and then he came up with this idea that was suggested by what we'd wanted to do with Norman Lear, of using characters from different fairy tales, all of whom would meet. And he held it together by inventing his own fairy tale, the one about the baker and the wife. And so that's how that came about. Hmm.
And I suppose the setting, the woods, brings another dimension to it because, of course, this has its own kind of mythic ancient history.
Well, you know, many fairy tales take place, many folk tales take place in the woods. And, you know, as Bettelheim pointed out, it represents the unconscious. I'm sure there are many other people who've talked about the woods in folk tales. You know, the fact that folk tales have lasted for the number of centuries they have means that they have very large and important metaphoric values to them, or they wouldn't have lasted. And stories like, for example, the Cinderella story exists in every culture, but in many different forms. But the idea of the mistreated heroine who becomes a princess through a set of circumstances and triumphs over over her miserable existence exists, as I say, in many cultures. So the reason that these fairy tales, which exist in many cultures, persist is that they have some kind of meaning that the Jungians and the Freudians and the Bettelheims all like to analyze. Mm-hmm.
Do you basically accept Bruno Bettelheim's argument that the arguments that about fairy tales? I mean, it's there's never a direct moral there. It has to emerge almost subconsciously.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know his work because everybody thinks we were influenced by Bettelheim for Into the Woods. We weren't at all. Had nothing to do with Bettelheim. In fact, we went. James had a friend who was a Jungian analyst, and we spoke to a Jungian analyst about the meaning of fairy tales. So we'd never read Bettelheim. I have read some of Bettelheim's book, but not the uses of enchantment, but not the whole thing. So I don't have any particular mm-hmm. feeling about that, no. And I must say, in writing the show, we never thought about it in large metaphorical terms. We really were just telling the story. Yeah. And let the metaphors fall when they may. Mm.
But it's interesting because in your book, you reflect on, for instance, the sort of the deep meaning of the woods, and you say it's the all-purpose symbol of the unconscious, the womb, the past, the dark place where we face our trials and emerge wiser or destroyed.
Yes, but the key word in that sentence is all-purpose. That's it represents anything you want it to represent. That's what I was saying. So the point is, it's as far as I'm concerned, it's irrelevant what it represents because that doesn't affect the telling of the story, uh-huh. and the telling of the story is all that matters.
Yeah, and the telling of the story, the making the characters come alive, making
yeah.
the characters so you feel like you can connect to them.
Well, character is story. I mean, you know, that's they're simultaneous. plotting is slightly different than story, but also that was the other thing since essentially the first act of. Into the Woods is a farce. It's very cleverly and heavily plotted, and pretty much second act too. Well, the second act gets more into the sort of moral dilemmas that the various characters face. But that's all we were concentrating on was story / character and plot.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in fact, haven't some people responded to the second act of Into the Woods as perhaps too dark? I mean, some of your characters die, and this goes past the usual telling of a fairy tale.
No, they're all great. You know, it depends on which version of fairy tales you hear. You know, you when you get the Grimm brothers versions of certain fairy tales, there's a great deal of blood and weirdness going on. The Grimm version of Cinderella is not the one that everybody knows. The one that everybody knows is the Perrier version, which is a much more whitewashed, pleasant version. But no, folk tales are filled with violence and death all the time. That isn't why we did it. It's just we were developing our own plot and carrying out logically, you know, you cut down a beanstalk and a giant falls, it should have a consequence. And it's not that does not devolve on the original folktale. The original folktale, that's the end of it. But if you're going to tell this on the stage, it should lead someplace. And James decided that it would lead to the fact that the giant had a wife, and that the characters who caused the giant's death had to face the consequences of it.
Mm-hmm. I was interested to read that you added a song for the London production, Our Little World, because you wanted to give the witch some maternal feelings for her daughter.
Yeah, Rapunzel. since so much of it deals, so much of the plotting deals with her feeling about her daughter, that to show the two of them having a good time together seemed to be cheating, and you had to see some kind of fondness going on instead of just the snarling and the frustration that Rapunzel feels being locked in the tower. So it's a tiny moment, but it was meant to be sort of playful between the mother and daughter.
And then the mother, the witch, actually climbs on top of
Rapunzel's
hair.
Yeah, no, it's funny. It's a funny image.
Now, I have heard that one of the more recent productions of Into the Woods was actually set in the woods in London's Regent Park.
Yeah.
That must have been kind of magical.
It was wonderful. It was wonderful. And there's a good chance that we may do it in Central Park, and which would be a swell setting for it. Yeah, it was. There was no stage per se. The entire set was made of trees and twigs, and kind of makeshift wooden ladders and platforms that were like parts of the trees and parts of the woods. So the whole thing, indeed, took place in the woods.
Wow. Now, I think it's pretty clear that this kind of musical theater that you've been describing, this highly literate theater for adults, has largely vanished. I mean, Broadway musicals are something quite different now. Family entertainment, you know, kind of Disney spectacles you take your kids to. And I assume you find all this rather depressing. But the question is why? What is it about our culture that no longer appreciates sort of the wit and sophistication of great musical theater?
Well, you're just talking about musical theater. It's what is widely referred to as the dumbing down of America, which is true. It's because what you're describing is also something that takes place in movies and all forms of entertainment. Everything is getting down to primary colors and immediacy and not taking the kinds of pleasures that you're talking about now. But there are musicals that they may not be the most popular ones, but there are musicals being written that have the values you're referring to, and there are certainly movies that are being made. They're just not the big blockbuster movies, and they're not the big blockbuster musicals. Those are the dumbing down.
Is there still an art? I mean, is there still an audience for appreciating this kind of more sophisticated art?
I think so. I don't see why not. Yeah, I think there is. It's probably lessening. That also has to do with the expensiveness of tickets and that sort of thing. And as you say, the desire for family entertainment, quote unquote. No, but you know, I think there is. It's just art goes through various phases anyway. Popular art, anyway, commercial art, and there was a time when the only thing that people wanted were British pop operas. Well, that time has passed, and now people want something different.
Now, I have to say, one of the most delicious parts of reading Look, I Made a Hat was your take on critics, which I'm guessing was kind of fun for you to write. And one of the things you say is it takes a long time to learn not to pay attention to critics, or at least not to let them distract you. I take it you do read all your reviews.
No, I don't. I read the New York Times because that's the one, and even that doesn't affect ticket sales the way it used to. But it used to affect ticket sales very directly and still has some effect. And that's the only one that really interests me. Occasionally I'll read a review if somebody sends me one that he or she thinks is interesting. But no, I don't see any point in reading the reviews. I sometimes read the foreign reviews. You know, if a show of mine opens in London, I want to find out how it's received. And so I'll read, you know, three or four of they have many newspapers over there. I'll read three or four of the leading papers, maybe two of the dailies and two of the Sundays, rather than just rely on word of mouth. But here in New York, I know how a show is received. I don't have to read the reviews. Mm.
So what is it you don't like about critics?
Oh, it's not what I don't like. It has nothing to do with that. I just make the point in the piece. I don't say about not liking critics. What I say is that there's a difference between a critic and a reviewer. And a critic is a journalist. A reviewer is a journalist who has to assess something on one seeing and one hearing. And for something as complex as a serious play or a musical that has any what you would call subtlety to it, that's a very difficult call to make, to write about something and assess it on one viewing. And if you're going to take it seriously, the way people sometimes take new operas seriously, a reviewer will get the score in advance and go over the score and then perhaps even see a dress rehearsal. But, you know, a new and serious opera is likely to get the kind of scrutiny that musicals don't. But then not many operas are done, so the critic has the time to do that, or the reviewer has the time to do that. Reviewers of musicals don't have, because they're also reviewing plays, and they may have three openings in one week, they don't get a chance to consider it. So their value is nil, except as publicists. And that's why critics are necessary, because they publicize a show. Mm-hmm. By merely writing the review, it makes the public aware that this show has opened. And if it sounds like it'll be fun to see, then it sells tickets. It doesn't matter whether if the review is very bad, of course, it scares the audience away, which is unfair to the play sometimes and sometimes not. It depends on your point of view. You might like a play a lot and you'd find it very unfair, and I might dislike it a lot and say, oh, yeah, the reviewer is absolutely on the nose. I'm certainly telling my friends not to see this dreadful show. It's all a matter of personal opinion. Mm-hmm. Whereas a critic is somebody who takes an overview, of an artist's life in art.
Well, what you're saying reminds me of something that John Updike told me some years back after he'd just gotten panned yet again by Michiko Kakutani, and he said it seems like she reads so many books that she has a secret hatred of all books.
it's very possible, you know. Yeah, I think that's why Frank Rich quit and became a political columnist. Thank God, because he's a superb one. But I think what happened I could see in his reviews that they were becoming sour over a period of time, and a little bitchery kept creeping in a little more. And I think he recognized it. He's a good friend. I've never actually asked him, but I think he actually recognized that he was curdling. And he thought, oops, got to get out of this because I'm losing my enthusiasm for the theater, the thing that made me start in the first place. I'm losing it. There's some critics who stay on, I'm talking now about journalists, of course, I'm talking about reviewers, who stay on because they need the job and they have nothing else to do and no other skills. And so they hang on for years and years and years and years and get, indeed, sourer and sourer and sourer. And perhaps that's true of Michiko Kakutani. She just gets sourer and sourer and sourer. And reading her reviews, yeah, I think that's exactly what's happening to her and has been happening to her for a very long time.
Hmm. Let me ask you about Frank Rich, because he wrote a wonderful profile of you some years ago where he described the signature Sondheim emotion as the aching, ambivalent, and often thwarted desire to connect with someone else. Do you think he got it right?
No, that's true of some of the shows and not true of others. It's not true of Pacific Overtures. It's not, you know, there are some shows that's true of and some shows it's not. The desire to connect is a fairly common theme in a great deal of narrative art, novels as well as plays. So I don't find it particularly significant. It may make a story attractive to me, but you could say that the desire to connect is behind virtually every story ever told. But it's certainly not prominent in West Side Story, in Gypsy, there are many shows that I've written in Forum. That's not a theme in any of those shows as a prominent theme. It is the prominent theme in Company. And maybe you could even say it is in Follies, but it's... It's certainly not true. It's certainly not true in Sweeney Todd.
I sense a certain resistance to having your work summed up in one sentence or one paragraph. You know, this is what makes a Sondheim piece.
Well, no, I think there are certain writers who, there are foxes and hedgehogs. There are certain writers who sort of stick to one plot of land and dig deep into it. Somebody like Tennessee Williams. But there are certain writers, like I like to contrast him with Paddy Chayefsky, who virtually never repeated himself, who wrote every conceivable kind of play. So I think that some writers do stick to a kind of thematic substance, something that informs virtually all of their plays or all of their books, and others not. And that also...
Are you saying you are the fox here?
I consider myself a fox. Sure, I really try not to repeat myself because I don't want to bore myself, and I also don't want to be too comfortable with what I'm writing. And you know, somebody once said that the only kind of writing one should do is the kind that frightens one. That is, say, if you're going to start on something, it better damned well scare you, because if it doesn't, you're likely to be just rewriting what you wrote before, which was, I must say, very easy to do. both musically and lyrically and in terms of the piece itself. I was smart enough to know, because after Gypsy, I got numbers of requests to do backstage or showbiz musicals, and I knew enough to say no to every single one of them.
So has that been sort of this whole process of getting scared as you're working in a piece, has that been a common occurrence for you?
Yeah, I'm always a little frightened, but you see, the nice thing is I don't write alone. I write with a collaborator. I always have a librettist, so the two of us are holding hands and entering the pit together. So I never feel that I'm out there on the end of the diving board all alone. Forgive me, my mixing metaphors here. But I'm never scared alone. And when you're scared with somebody, you're not paralyzed with fright. You're just scared.
Hmm. You are now in your early 80s. Are you still working on any new theater pieces?
I'm just about to plunge into something scary again, yeah.
Wow. So I guess we will just wait to see.
I guess I will wait to see.
Thank you. This has been a pleasure.
Okay, Steve. Nice to meet you.